things. I'm going to take a chance here and try to keep up with Austin. This is really scary. I have my notes on digital, so I don't know if you caught that pun, taking a chance to catch up with Austin. He actually did a really good job of setting up my sermon, so I appreciate that. Just a couple of comments before I get into the message. I spoke with Freeman this morning, and he did want me to say hello to all of you. They're with their family, and if you know a little bit of history of the Coons family, many of you do, they've had a number of tragedies of this sort. I would just say from a human perspective, certainly more than their share. So there's been a lot of things like that over the past year. We have an employee who most of you would know, Les Miller. His son died of an apparent drug overdose in the last week, so that's been very difficult. Most of the drug overdoses today are actually unintentional, because the drugs that are out there on the market are so badly put together that it's easy to take too much. So they're dealing with that. So we were in Germany for 2 months instead of 3 weeks, and it was, I guess, a good time. We're grateful that we had the opportunity to go through the treatment. I'm feeling great. I do have a little bit of neurological damage from the Lyme, which is probably going to follow me around for a while. Susan, we're still trying to figure out how to deal with her situation, but again, as I mentioned, it's good to be here. Now, while I was in Germany, I have a lot of material. I'm not sure. I was trying to figure out what to speak on, because while we were over there, I did have some downtime and the ability to reflect and also study and do some research. Some of that I will share during the course of my sermon. I cataloged over 2,000 pages of 1525 to 1640 history. From the archives in Munich, which was quite interesting. And, you know, we think we have difficult times here. Difficult times in different times have different meaning. So I'll share some of that as we go along. So organized here. So the title of my message today is The Primary Structures That Shape Culture. The Primary Structures That Shape Culture. About 10 years ago, I think it was, maybe a little bit longer, in my work to understand how to best organize organizations, I came to the conclusion, kind of intuitively, that structure shapes culture. And I'm not really talking about it is architecture, but more on a philosophical level than maybe what we think of typically as structure. We'll get into this a little bit deeper as we go along. But basically, the reason I came to that conclusion, like I said, kind of intuitively, is in organizations today in Western culture, we're typically organized in a pyramidal structure, a top-down organizational chart. And I had come to the conclusion, actually, when I was working for the church in Germany, that chart is actually upside down from a biblical perspective. And a much better model to organize structures would be a tree. And somewhere I read that you shall be like a tree. You know, plant it by the waters and bear fruit in its season. And Jesus said, I am the vine and you are the branches. And so it's been remarkable in studying that on how well it works and functions. But while in Germany, and a number of things that I've been writing, and this is kind of, I'm not going to tell you anything new or any new truth. This is hopefully something, maybe a new perspective on old stuff, and you'll see what I mean by that. But culture has a visible life. You know, we have institutions, we have conflicts, we have language, typical things that we think about in culture. And if you watch the Super Bowl, you see the distortion of culture. I didn't watch it, by the way. I'm not into all of that stuff. But it's getting really bad when you look at language and culture, and particularly music. But what is visible, and this is, I'm going to share what I think are a couple of important distinctions. What is visible is not primary. What is visible is not primary. Beneath every culture lies a structure, and the structure is the architecture within which life unfolds, the genetic blueprint that determines how time is inhabited, how meaning is formed, how authority operates, how boundaries are drawn, and how relationships endure. It defines what a culture can sustain. That was a mouthful. Let me summarize it in a very simple way. The structures that most profoundly shape us, the things that shape us every day, even as little children, are so deeply embedded that they appear natural and we rarely question them. They are, let me give you a list. They are so constant that they feel natural. Write that down. We'll come back to it. They are so constant they feel natural. You know, I grew up Amish, and you know, the Amish are now saying, I found this interesting, a furniture store owner put out a video, this would have been unthinkable even a couple years ago, saying that Amish is not a religion, it's a lifestyle. And his point was, we have chosen, we're Christians, but we have chosen to live a different lifestyle that is cultural in nature. Now, when I grew up, I mean, the mode of dress and all those cultural features, they were so embedded, now 500 years, that they seemed natural. We never thought of the fact that I didn't feel different. It's just normal. Next one. These structures are so inherited that they feel inevitable. I mean, it just happens. They are so embedded that they appear neutral or natural, and so pervasive that they dissolve into normalcy. Because they feel natural, they are rarely questioned, and because they feel inevitable, they're rarely examined. Because they appear neutral, they are rarely challenged. Now, there are different ways to frame this, but I have enumerated 7 biblical structures that ironically find their framework in Genesis chapter 1 and John 1 and Genesis 2 and 3. So, I mean, Austin, he's just, we were talking last night. No, I'm kidding. But there are 7 what I call primary biblical structures, and of course their rivals, that God intended to shape us with. And Satan is the great imitator who always creates a fraud to imitate the structure that God has given us for our own good. So what I was trying to think about how to do this, and I think what I'll do is I'm going to run through all 7. And then I want to focus on number 1. Because I, you know, over the course of the last several months, I've come to the conclusion that number 1 is preeminent. And it shapes us and forms us in ways that I don't even pretend to fully understand. And it's found in Genesis chapter 1, verse 1, and in John chapter 1, verse 1. And we all know what those verses say. In Genesis chapter 1, it says, in the beginning God. In John chapter 1, verse 1, it says, in the beginning was. And what God created in the beginning was this structure that we don't even think about called time. There was no time prior to in the beginning. It just, you know, that's very difficult for a human mind to comprehend. I mean, what was before the beginning? That's not my point today, but he created time and its companion, rhythm, time and rhythm. You know, he created, if you walk through the Genesis chapter 1 narrative, you know, he spoke, and then he created days, first day, second day, third day, fourth day, fifth day, sixth day, seventh day. You know what I just thought about this week? Maybe you've all thought about this. The Sabbath and the holy days are the only days that have a name in the Bible. Now, today is Saturday. You know, yesterday was Friday, and then you had Tuesday, and you have all these names. And, I mean, I make that point. Nobody thinks. Who questions why today is Saturday? Very, very few people. It's just normal. It's Saturday. It actually is named after the god of Saturn. I mean, Saturn, Saturday, Friday, I'm not sure, I don't remember. Thursday is the god of Thor. So, I mean, these are all Roman gods after which the days were named. So the first structure, the first biblical structure is time and rhythm. Let's go to Genesis chapter 1, and we'll just look at a couple of verses here. In verse 1, it says, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. The earth was without form and void. Darkness was on the face of the deep. And the Spirit of God was hovering over the face of the waters. So this is a very condensed, precise statement. And one of the things about God is God never creates disorder. And yet in verse 2 we read that the earth became formless and void. The Hebrew is tohu wabohu. This is not something God created. And the best explanation that I've found is what is called in theology circles the gap theory. That there was that God created eons of time back, we don't know how long, and then Satan rebelled and created chaos. I mean, that's one of the things we can debate about, but I think it's a pretty solid thesis. And then it says in verse 3, and this naturally leads to the second structure. And God said, let there be light, and there was light. This corresponds with John chapter 1. John chapter 1 says, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. So the Greek word behind that is logos, and there's a whole construct about what that word means. But the second structure, again, think about time and rhythm. It's just the days of the week, the weekend. We all follow it. In fact, now I digress. I get into these business meetings, and I was invited to the CEO of the glass supplier's house. He's an interesting character from New York, and what he does is he invites you to his house, and then he cooks. He's a good cook, actually. So I went to his house along with engineers from all over Europe and as far away as Australia. And he's there cooking. He said, hey, John, tell them about your Amish background. Okay, so that took, you know, 10 minutes. So we sit down to eat, and he says, hey, John, how do you know that the 7-day week we have today is the same 7-day week of Genesis. It was 8 o'clock when he asked that question. At 10:30, we were still talking. But think about it. The seven-day week is universally accepted around the world. I mean, there are a couple variants. There are some, I Googled this, and there are apparently some tribes that have a 10-day week. I mean, but it's also accurate to say that today, in our modern world, the seven-day weekly cycle is universally accepted as the calendar. And the only, I challenge all of you, I challenge you to see if you can disprove this. I've not been able to. The only basis for a seven-day week is Genesis chapter 1. And the seven-day week is not connected to any cosmic cycle. The month is connected to the moon, the year is connected to the sun, and you know, we have those cycles. The seven-day week just is. So in a weird kind of way, the entire world, no matter how atheistic they are, acknowledges God as creator by virtue of observing a seven-day week. The second structure, the second biblical structure, we'll go to John chapter 1, is words and meaning. Hey, Austin, this is kind of neat. I can just, you know, maybe I'll get over my fear of not having paper up here. The second one is words and meaning. John chapter 1. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God, and he was in the beginning with God. All things were made through him, and without him nothing was made that was made. I mean, this is an important point I'll just point out. The Word became flesh and dwelled among us. You know, if there's any question who the person was who created in Genesis, here's your answer. Because all things were created by him. So the second structure, again, is words and meaning. Number three is nature and order. Nature and order. This comes right from Genesis chapter 1. You know, we live in a, you know, if Satan had his way, it would just be mass confusion and push things together. God separated the water from the earth. I mean, he separated the days into 24-hour periods. He created order out of chaos. And you will find that, I mean, the distortions and the disruptions that Satan always gives always attacks these. I mean, there are forces out there always attacking these structures and forces. He wants disorder, not order and distinction. So that was number three. Again, there's a lot more to be. Oh, under that also fits, you know, God made man, he says, in our image. Interesting pronouns. Differentiation is good. Embodiment is real. Limits define a flourishing environment. You think about the fact that at the end of the creation week, we go from tohu wabohu to a garden in which they could eat every tree except the one. Point number four, relationships and belonging. This is also from John chapter 1. And the Word was with God. In Genesis chapter 2, verse 18, it is not good that man should be alone. Point number five, authority and organization. So we have, in the very beginning, authority was given to the human beings to dress and keep the garden and have dominion and rule over the fish of the sea and the birds of the air. You see, tending and keeping a garden speaks to accountability for our environment and for the animals that God created. But we are not animals that just evolved to a higher form, as evolution would suggest. We were created in the image of God. I mean, there are distortions of this. You know, the Romans and the Egyptians, if you look at how they, as Jesus said, the Gentiles lorded over them. And he specifically states that you are not to be that way, but that you should be the servant, not the lording over. You know, we have the prophecy, I think this is in, Isaiah or Jeremiah, that God is going to establish, resurrect David and establish him over his kingdom to be a shepherd king, which is, from a cultural standpoint, one of the reasons that the Israelites ended up in Goshen is because they were shepherds, and the Egyptian culture despised shepherds because it was inconsistent with the value system that they had in the structures, their pyramidal structure with Pharaoh on the top. Now, this is an interesting one for our current. Number six, place and boundaries. You know, the garden had a boundary. And it says in Genesis chapter 2, verse 8, just to summarize this, the Lord planted a garden eastward in Eden, and he placed the man that he had made in the garden and said, you may eat from every tree except this one. And that is, if you want to take note of Acts chapter 17, verse 26, it says that God determined their appointed times and boundaries. Rome dissolved boundaries through conquest. Identity became imperial rather than rooted. I mean, it was just an imperial empire that forced their way and dominated culture. That was never God's intent. And finally, number seven, work and provision. Work's a good thing. God worked 6 days, and then he rested from all his labor. Genesis chapter 2, verse 15 says that he put them into the garden to work it and keep it, one translation says. The more common translation is to tend it, to work in that garden to provide. I mean, I suppose each one of these is a sermon, because when you think about today and the general cultural tendency, people want to have without working for it. And, you know, there are structures in place that enable individuals to do things like that. So, what do all of these have in common from 2 to 7? They all have this in common, and actually if you walk down through it, I want to go back to 1 and build that out, but you had to have time prior to words and meaning, and you can't have relationships without prior having words and meaning. All of them sequentially follow one after the other, and it comes right out, wouldn't you know it, of Genesis chapter 1. God created it that way. So it shouldn't surprise us that Satan will do everything as he did from the very beginning. He broke into paradise with God present. And the first family, the firstborn became a murderer. I mean, it's just, when we start thinking about that, It's astonishing. But the other thing that I mentioned earlier, from 2 to 7, all of them operate inside the structure of time. We get paid by the hour when we work, right? Time, I've come to believe, is the preeminent structure that shapes so many things that we don't even think about. So in the time we have left, what I want to do is to walk through the biblical structure of time and then look at its counterfeit that forms and shapes culture worldwide, and the West in particular, on a seven-day weekly cycle, but it's a counterfeit. And most people don't even think about it. It's just so natural that it is accepted. So back to kind of the statement that shapes the message. The structures that most profoundly shape us are so embedded. They're embedded so deeply that they appear natural. Let's go back to Genesis chapter 1 again. And I'm going to jump around here a little bit. But under this, what I've called preeminent structure, time and the rhythm of time. So you have to have time before you can have rhythm. And the two are, shall we say, intrinsically connected. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth, and the earth was without form and void. And darkness was on the face of the deep, and the Spirit of God was hovering over the face of the waters. So we have a truly chaotic situation. It's just a mess. It's tohu wabohu. Then God said, "Let there be light," and there was light, and God saw the light that it was good, and God divided the light from the darkness, and God called the light day, and the darkness he called night. So evening and morning were the first day. I was talking to somebody this week. I don't even remind talk to too many. I was talking to somebody, and they pointed out, it was our HR manager. And he, I've always wondered, you know, God created light on the first day, but the sun and the moon and the stars, he created what? I think it's the third day. And I've wondered, how did that work? And he just made, I don't even remember what we're talking about, but he made this offhand comment, and I thought, that kind of makes sense. He said, the first 2 days, God was the light. He just spoke it into existence. He didn't have a sun, moon, and stars yet. I suppose that's something we could debate on, but I thought, that sounds plausible. So you have a condition here where everything is tohu wabohu. And then God speaks, while the word spoke, the Logos spoke, as we learn in John chapter 1, and all of a sudden you have light. Now we have it so nice. You know, back in the day we had to take a Coleman lantern and pump the thing up. It was gasoline, and then strike a match and put it in there, and it stunk. And creating light was a little bit more difficult than just, you know, flipping the switch. But the contrast between light and darkness is huge. And it is no accident that more crimes get done in the darkness of night. You see how this kind of structure we don't even think about shapes the bad culture of thievery. People want to do more bad things at night under the cover of darkness. So you have here tohu wabohu, and God creates the first day, and the first thing he does is make a distinction between darkness and light. Continuing, verse 4. And God saw the light that it was good, and God divided the light from the darkness. Remember, one of the structures is this distinction of order versus chaos. Then God called the light day, and he called the darkness night. So evening and morning were the first day. Then God said, let there be a firmament in the midst of the waters, and let it divide the waters from the waters. And God made the firmament and divided the waters which were under the firmament from the waters which were above the firmament, and it was so. And God called the firmament heaven, and evening and morning were the second day. Then God said, let the waters under the heavens be gathered together into one place, and let the dry land appear, and it was so. And God called the dry land earth, and the gathering together of the waters he called seas, and God saw that it was good. And then God said, let the earth bring forth grass, herbs, and yields, and seed, and fruit trees that yields fruit according to its kind, whose seed is in itself on the earth, and it was so. So here, God created genetics, which we have only begun to understand. I saw a meme recently, you know, if you take all the genetic chains in your body, how many times it would go to the moon and back. I mean, it's remarkable, and yet, you know, we all have a genetic fingerprint. Even twins, even identical twins, have different fingerprints, and it's never been two that are alike. We are created after the God kind, which we'll read here in a moment. So the evening and the morning were the third day. Then God said, let there be lights in the firmament of the heavens to divide the day from the night, and let them be for signs, seasons, and for days and years. So on the fourth day, so the first 3 days, God was the source of light. I think I said, misspoke earlier, it was on the first day that he created these. Now, I want to focus for a minute here on verse 14. Let there be lights in the firmament of the heavens to divide the day from the night, and let them be for signs, seasons, and for days and years. The Hebrew word in here is moedim. Moedim is appointed times. I mean, the moon and the moedim determine the different festivals. You see, God created appointments for us. The question is simply, I mean, here is Austin again. You don't want to be late for an appointment. In fact, you will, as he said, you will skip the shower in order not to be late for the appointment. You know, what are we willing to do to not miss an appointment with God? I took a shower this morning, just so you know. So we'll come back to that here in a little bit. But this is biblical time. God didn't let us guessing. He has appointments in time. And let them be for lights in the firmament of the heavens to give light to the earth. And it was so. And again, this is, the sun comes up every morning. Some people appreciate it, some people notice, but we just take it for granted. These cycles shape and form us even as little children. Anybody that has had kids will know that babies disrupt time, first of all, but they're also shaped by it. Then God made two great lights, the greater light to rule the day and the lesser light to rule the night, and he made stars also. And he set them in the firmament of the heavens to give light on the earth and to rule over the day and over the night and to divide the light from darkness, and God saw that it was good. You see, how many times have we read divide? God differentiates day from night, light from darkness. There are distinctions, and distinctions matter. And they're not bad. The differences, I mean, if you look at all the people in this room, I mean, there are a lot of differences. But those differences can either divide or strengthen us. I mean, the latter is what it should be. Verse 24, then God said, let the earth bring forth living creatures according to its kind, cattle and creeping things, and the beasts of the earth, each according to its kind. And God made the beasts of the earth according to its kind, cattle according to its kind, and everything that creeps on the earth according to its kind. And God saw that it was good. And then he shifts gears in verse 26. Then God said, let us make man in our image according to our likeness, and let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, over the birds of the air, and over cattle, and over all the earth, over every creeping thing that creeps on the earth. So God made man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them. So he blessed them and said to them, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and subdue it and have dominion over the fish of the sea, over the birds of the air, and over every living thing that moves on the earth. And God said, see, I have given you every herb that yields seed, which is on the face of all the earth, and every tree which yields seed, that it shall be for food. Verse 31, then God said, saw everything that he had made, and indeed it was very good. And so evening and morning were the sixth day. So now we have created out of tohu wabohu six distinct 24-hour periods in which God did his work, all within the structure of time. In fact, he created a daily rhythm of time after creating time in the beginning. That is, the cycles are regulated by the rising and setting of the sun and the moon, the months by the moons. Chapter 2. Then the heavens and the earth and all the host of them were finished. On the seventh day, God ended his work which he had done, and he rested on the seventh day from all his work which he had done. Verse 3. Then God blessed the seventh day and sanctified it, because in it he rested from all his work which God had created and made. This is the history of the heavens and the earth when they were created in the day that God made the earth and the heavens. So he concluded the week by sanctifying, or some translations say, make holy, the seventh day. And that's really interesting when you think about it. And I'm lined up with a lawyer who wants to debate me on this issue. This should be pretty interesting. On this issue of which commandments are in effect. I mean, we all know that the commandments, this big bad law, has been done away with. Well, now, wait a minute. The Sabbath that was created holy, we cannot create anything, make anything holy. We can just determine whether or not we're going to desecrate it. But the interesting thing about the Ten Commandments is, when you think about it, is that the fourth commandment is the only one that predates everything. It predates the so-called fall, the sin in the garden. It predates law and commandment. Did you hear of any commandments? Well, I guess be fruitful and multiply is a commandment. But, you know, he hadn't even commanded them not to eat. You know, that's in chapter 2. So the fourth commandment, the Sabbath in the Ten Commandments, is the only one that predates everything. And yet there is no serious theologian who would argue that because the Mosaic law is abolished, apparently, That we are now free to commit adultery or to steal or to covet or to do any of the other. It's just a Sabbath. You ever thought about that? That's the only one. That's really the only one that's done away with. And I think what we will see here, I'll jump back and forth here, and this somehow, when I was in Germany, really crystallized for me. The Reformation, I mean, Rome put a calendar in place in the fourth century. There's really no evidence of Sunday keeping till about 130 AD. And then there's the Quattrodeciman controversy in around about 190 AD, where the Bishop of Rome reprimands the Polycrates in Asia Minor for keeping the Passover in the 14th day of Nisan. Rome had already progressed to Easter and adopted they retooled the pagan festival into Easter and tried to make it Christian. So here's something for you to think about and consider. To be successful, you have to change time first before you change doctrine. You change the practice first, and later you make the theology line up. And this is really what happened, because by the time of the fourth century, when Constantine legalized Christianity, the keeping of Sunday, Christmas, Easter, and all of those holidays had become normalized. It became one of those things that we just do. So a lot of people, I mean, it seems like even the Jerusalem church challenged it, and those in Asia Minor who were directly influenced by, in the case of Jerusalem, Peter, and in the case of Asia Minor, there are more records by John, the late John Apostle, whose disciple was Polycarp, and then Polycrates. They pushed back. Everybody else was kind of like, well, you know, it's become normal. And it formed them. So jumping forward, I'm going to go on a little tour here, if you'll just come with me. So when the Reformation happened, and I wanted to look this up this morning, and I failed to do this, so bear with me. It was a relatively short period of time from the time that the Bible was translated into the common language, and I'm going to use German as the example, there were others, but Luther translated it into what is now High German. It was a relatively, I want to say 5 or 10 years. It wasn't long at all. You put the Word of God into the hands of the common people, and they follow a relatively simple formula that most of you are familiar with. You begin reading your Bible seriously, you dust it off, and you start doing what the Bible says, and whoopee-doo, I mean, all of a sudden, some pretty dramatic changes take place. And that's really what happened. Gutenberg, you know, invented a screw and a movable type and was able to print on a more affordable basis. So Luther and Zwingli did their reformations in Germany and Switzerland, and it was really radical. I mean, it's really radical of doing things. I mean, they wanted to reform Rome. They found out that was a lot harder than they thought. But the one thing that they did not do, I mean, stop. I found a quote from a Martin Rothkegel. He's professor of history at a university in Berlin. that he had found a quote of Andreas Fischer, who was a Sabbatarian Anabaptist. I've read his books. I knew the man. That in this statement, I think it was 1531 or 2, he had a quote from a prisoner in the Passau prison in Germany who said he was baptized by Andreas Fischer in 1528. So you had the Anabaptists who went further than Luther or Zwingli, because and they didn't baptize their children. And not baptizing your child, we think we have problems. Not baptizing a child, if you taught people to do that, was a capital crime. You get your head removed, you get burned at a stake, so forth. It's interesting, though, that in 1524, a gentleman who was a close associate to Luther wrote a tract, which I'm still trying to get my hands on, called Vom Sabbat, about the Sabbath, advocating and made the proposal to Luther that the fourth commandment, for the reasons that I just mentioned, because it predates everything, is still in force. Luther sidelined him, because it was one thing to manage indulgences and change doctrine and do all of these things, but trying to revert back to biblical time was a bridge too far. It just was too much. Now, the Anabaptists then took it farther and suffered immensely. And then there were, tracking back to what I wanted to tell you, so Rothkegel had this quote, and he referenced a Blechkasten. Now, only a few people will. There's a tin chest in the archive in Munich, and when I saw that, I said, I gotta see this thing. So I went to Munich and I got myself approved to the special reading room for the special collections and spent an afternoon there. This tin chest had over 2,000 pages that records the eradication of Teufeltum, the Anabaptists in Passau. So I found the one that he had referenced and did my thing with my phone and copied it all. And then I thought, this is too good. So I went back another afternoon and did all of them. So I've got about 2,000 pages of material to at some point go through. But here's the thing that I didn't know. I had known for some time that there was a minority, I assumed a relatively small one, of Anabaptists that were Sabbatarian. It was actually a much bigger group than I thought, well over 20,000 at one point. In fact, I think you could probably make an argument that they were larger, and they were in Transylvania, than the what you might call the mainline Anabaptists. They got crushed. So I'm just going to quote here. I wrote a little thing called "What Over 10,000 Sabbatarian Anabaptists Could Not Restore, but Died Trying." The attempt to recover biblical time during the Radical Reformation represents one of the most determined and least remembered movements of covenant obedience in Christian history. Between the 1520s and the early 17th century, tens of thousands of believers across Central and Eastern Europe embraced a form of discipleship that sought not merely to reform doctrine, but to reorder life itself according to the time God had sanctified at creation and codified in covenant. Among them were the Sabbatarian Anabaptists, men and women who believed that faithfulness to Christ required obedience not only in beliefs and ethics, but also in keeping God's appointed times. That was, These believers were not marginal eccentrics. Contemporary records indicate that over 10,000 adherents, measured in households rather than isolated individuals, were associated with Sabbatarian Anabaptists or Anabaptist adjacent communities between 1530 and 1620, spanning Moravia, Silesia, Transylvania, Slovakia, Poland, and parts of Hungary. Their ranks included peasants, artisans, scholars, pastors, and nobles. They organized congregations, translated scriptures, wrote catechetical tracts, and developed disciplined communal lives ordered around the Seventh-day Sabbaths, biblical feasts, and covenant obedience. Yet almost none of them survived. The reason was not theological failure or moral collapse or lack of commitment. It was structural resistance enforced by imperial power. Sabbatarian Anabaptists challenged what no reform movement before or since had successfully overturned: the calendar itself. In doing so, they threatened the deepest mechanism by which post-Constantinian Christianity maintained culture and political coherence. And these were the Habsburgs. I mean, the Habsburgs reigned for over 600 years. The execution of Sabbatarian Anabaptists was not incidental to the broader persecution. It was targeted. While imperial authorities, to some extent, could tolerate dissent over baptism, church policy, or even pacifism to a limited degree. I mean, that was one of the things. Pacifism was deeply embedded in the Anabaptist movement. Calendar dissent was intolerable. Time-structured labor, taxation, courts, markets, festivals, imperial unity to keep the Seventh-day Sabbath was to publicly defect from the empire's rhythm every week. It just was intolerable. So that is not, when you think about it, the Sabbath and the holy days have not been consistently kept at scale. I mean, it's been consistently kept in the church and other streams and communities. But even in ancient Israel, I mean, I think it was the reform of Josiah where they said that the feast hadn't been kept this way since Joshua the son of Nun. It was always just here or there are elements of it. So that, my friends, is what we're up against. And that's, you know, we've all had our unique experiences. When you mess with time, it really becomes difficult. Okay, so let's look at a biblical time. Take a look here. Oh my, we got problems. Let's see here. Okay. Isaiah chapter 58. You all know Leviticus 23. You all know Exodus 31. You know, isn't it interesting that in Exodus chapter 31, verse 13, the Sabbath is a sign between you and me. You know, if you want a cultural identity that expands over any culture, keep the Sabbath. And I've visited those people at the, literally up in Finland at the Arctic Circle. And on mats on the borders of Burma and in Mauritia, and it's all the same. It sets them apart just like Exodus said it would. Isaiah chapter 58. It's your fault. You were paying attention. You were with me. And I lost track of time. Isaiah chapter 58, verse 13 says something really interesting. If you turn away your foot from the Sabbath, from doing your pleasure on my holy day, I mean, that lifts. I mean, what is the pleasure that you will refrain from doing on my holy day and instead call the Sabbath a delight? I mean, that opens it up. You have to answer that question. That's the remarkable thing about God's commandments. They're not coercive. They're designed for individual decision and embracement. Continuing, from doing your pleasure on my holy day and call the Sabbath a delight, a holy day of the Lord, honorable, and shall honor him, not doing your own ways, nor finding your own pleasures, nor speaking your own words. Verse 14, here's the promise, the blessing. Then you shall delight yourself in the Lord, and I will cause you to ride on the high hills of the earth and feed you with the heritage, of Jacob your father. The mouth of the Lord has spoken it. The command is really simple. Do not work, rest. But if you want to maximize the pleasure, you delight in the Lord and not in your own pleasure. Just a couple pages earlier, in chapter 56, just want to read a couple of verses here. Verse 2, blessed is the man who does this, the son of man who lays hold on it, who keeps from defiling the Sabbath and keeps his hand from doing evil. Do not let the son of the foreigner who has joined himself to the Lord speak, saying, the Lord has utterly separated me from his people. Nor let the eunuch say, here I am, a dry tree. For thus says the Lord to the eunuchs who keep my Sabbath and choose what pleases me and hold fast to my covenant, even them I will give in my house and within my walls a place and a name better than the sons and daughters. I will give them an everlasting name, and they shall not be cut off. I mean, this demolishes the notion that the Sabbath was not intended for Gentiles. But let's go back. I want to conclude here with the things most people just don't think about. And yet they are shaped by it. And these are the counterfeits and the calendar of Rome, if you will, that is so normal that we just don't think about it. It's Saturday today, or we now have the Holy Weekend. Have a nice weekend. It's a politically correct way of wishing somebody a nice time for 2 days off before it was woke. I mean, the wokeism probably has an even more different term. Okay, so here are some of the, you know, you have the Sabbath rhythm. Time is patterned by work and rest. Sabbath precedes law and sin. Production is interrupted weekly. Bear with me. Just bear with me for just a second. We need to think about what happened in Sinai in its context. And I will, with my lawyer friends, I have invented a new term called grace law. That is a synonym to case law, okay? And I am going to argue that what happened in Sinai was grace law. It was the most gracious thing that any people, much less a slave's people, had ever been given by any authority. And here it was the Most High God who gave them what was unthinkable at that time, one day off in seven. When they were slaves in Egypt, kid you not, they worked every day. What is legalistic, burdensome, or bondage in that? You cannot make a rational case for it. It's all good. In Egypt, you had monumental time. It was documented in the pyramids. And we embrace that in our culture. Go to Washington, D.C. and look at all the monuments. It goes all the way back to Egypt. Shouldn't surprise us, because Joseph married an Egyptian princess. So the Manassites and the Ephraimites are half Egyptian. Solomon married an Egyptian princess. So you have this, you know, this amalgamation, this syncretism down through time. Greece had civic and philosophical time. Rome had spectacular and expansionistic time. The calendar was ordered by triumphs, games. I mean, think about the highlights of the year. You know, you have football, and you know, you have this holy weekend. It's ordered, and that's a Roman tradition. And then we have today consumer time. You know, it's the modern mall. I guess that's that shows that I'm a little bit dated. It's Amazon now, where you go shopping. Calendar is structured around retail peaks and fiscal quarters. Christmas and Easter are framed by economic crescendo. And if you have anything to do with retail, Black Friday it's called Black Friday for a reason. Retail loses money all year, and they make it into the black for Thanksgiving, Christmas, and Easter. Rest is redefined as entertainment. Digital life eliminates communal pause. Productivity metrics replace Sabbath trust. The Sabbath structurally asserts that God provides, power is limited, and labor is not ultimate, and human worth is not productivity. I mean, what God created out of chaos in Genesis is structural. But it is an enormous blessing combined to the tyranny. I mean, top-down and pyramids always lead to tyranny of some form or fashion. You know, idolatry occurs when a created structure is treated as ultimate, when time is organized around something other than God. In Rome, empire was ultimate. In Egypt, the Pharaoh was ultimate. And dare I say it, in Catholicism, the Pope is ultimate. The Sabbath confronts all of them. It declares that God is ultimate, that time belongs to him, that rest is obedience, trust is structural, not sentimental. There are seven biblical structures that God created for our benefit. And when he created them, he said it was good. It's the counterfeits that have been built over time that are so deeply embedded that they just seem normal. Think about it. You know, take Christmas. I mean, Christmas is perhaps one of the most diabolical pagan festivals that have been foisted on. But we're affected by it. I mean, we don't work on Christmas. I mean, we take the day off. And we don't even think about it. Because that structure of time that's a counterfeit of biblical time is so embedded in our culture that we don't even think about it. That's why it is so formative. That's all, folks. Sorry for the extra time.